Hello, everybody, and welcome back to 100 Years and 100 Movies. Today's day 31 of the season of The Witch. Our countdown is complete, and I'm happy to say Merry Christmas, motherfuckers. I mean, Happy Halloween to everybody here. That's it. We've come to 31 days of horror, and in my mind, there's only one thing that we can finish on in this celebration of Halloween, and that's talking about the movies of Stephen King. Now, Stephen King has only ever actually directed like one movie, but he's been involved as a producer, as a writer for plenty of adaptations of his work. And Stephen King, of course, is one of the most influential horror writers of this generation, and he's my favorite author. And the reason that I wanted to talk about Stephen King as kind of leaving him for last, there's a couple of reasons. One, we are in this, we've been in this Stephen King renaissance where in the last 3 or 4 years, we've just gotten all these great movies and TV adaptations, streaming adaptations of his work. Everything from like It Chapter One to The Outsider on HBO and everything in between. And not that everything's been great. I mean, I love The Dark Tower, but the Dark Tower movie was not good. But more personally than all of that, as I've said in the past, when I was young, I didn't care for horror at all. It scared me. I was a little pussy, which, I mean, to be fair, I was a little kid, but that all changed when I was 13 and someone, let me borrow their copy of The Dark Half. And the great thing about Stephen King books and in the heyday of like the 80s and 90s and well, 70s, 80s, and the early 90s, his books always had this like amazing artwork on the hardcovers and on the paperbacks. And this image that was on The Dark Half just really grabbed my attention. And the person that owned the book let me borrow it. And granted, like I said, I was like 13 at the time, so I probably shouldn't have been reading Stephen King. But reading this opened my eyes to a whole new world of horror. And I think one of the great things about Stephen King is that even though basically everything he's written, but not everything he's written, but the majority of it is in the horror genre, his books really aren't necessarily about horror. They're more about Americana, and they're more about society and kind of his own experiences and translating that, and people's experiences and translating that into these stories. And, you know, there just happens to be vampires or some kind of existential dread or zombies or evil spirits that are taking people over or telekinetic powers. You know, it's this melding of the two. It's this idea where Stephen King is able to kind of talk about our ills as a society, his point of view on them at least, and the things that are really kind of bubbling under the surface with our society, really commenting on what's going on here in America, what's been going on in America for, you know, the last 40 plus years. But being able to serve that in a way where the people, where everyone's able to digest it because it's being fed to you as a story about a werewolf or a crazy maniac murderer. You know, it's these elements that really kind of hide what these stories really are about. And now The Dark Half isn't necessarily Stephen King's best book, but it got me interested enough in to continue just reading his books. And from there, after I've read plenty of his books, and Stephen King is an extremely prolific writer. I don't think I've even read half of his works. But I have read quite a few, and I really enjoy his work. And The Dark Half itself was actually turned into a movie in 1993. It's not a very good movie. I mean, it was directed by George Romero, who, you know, he worked alongside Stephen King on a lot of different projects, such as Creepshow and The Black Cat. I think that's called The Black Cat, or Cat's Eye. I'm sorry, Cat's Eye, not The Black Cat. So they worked in conjunction in a lot of different movies, and The Dark Half isn't, like I said, it isn't great. It's okay. But I mention it just because, like I said, The Dark Half itself, that book was the one that introduced me to the world of Stephen King. But when we talk about Stephen King, I think really the movie that we start with and the movie that really kind of catapulted Stephen King into the cultural zeitgeist is 1976's Carrie. Carrie is based on, well, the book of the same name, which, if I remember correctly, was Stephen King's second novel. But this is the book that really kind of made him. And the movie itself, Stephen King has always said that the success of this movie really kind of made his career. He wrote a pretty good book that ended up just hitting with the masses. And Carrie was super popular at the time and has been very influential in the history of horror. And as I said, you know, Stephen King kind of credits that success for people wanting more of his works and kind of leading to this run fueled by drugs and by alcohol and cocaine, where he very prolifically wrote for like the next, like more or less 15 years, maybe not 15, like 10 years, more or less. And just kind of kept churning out these great stories. And he kind of was set from there as an author. But Stephen King is always someone that's really been, he's always kind of worn his influences, and not just like literary influences, but like the music that he loves, the movies that he grew up with, things like that, the town that he grew up in, they're kind of embroiled in his book. And if it weren't for the success of Carrie, then that might not have ever happened. He might have just been someone who was like a niche horror author who had some success, right? Carrie is one of the best horror movies of the 70s. It was directed by Brian De Palma, starring Sissy Spacek as the titular Carrie, who I think this role kind of really cemented her as kind of a person to watch. You know, like this movie really led to are much greater things for Sissy Spacek. And the movie itself and the story of Carrie, because it's very similar to the novel, is that we follow Carrie, this titular girl who is brought up by a very religious mother who has this very almost zealot-like view of religion. And Carrie herself is kind of an odd girl and has no friends. And she gets bullied by some of the more popular kids, including John Travolta and PJ Souls, amongst others, who make fun of her. And it leads up to the prank that I think, the scene that everyone, I think, thinks of when they think of the movie Carrie, where she gets doused with pig's blood. And, of course, this being a horror story, Carrie has telekinetic powers, which she uses to exact bloody revenge, much like in a slasher movie, and kill all her tormentors, including her mother. And the scene with her mother, it's almost this orgasmic experience for her, being closer to dying and being closer to God. And Carrie herself, you know, perishes as well. And just like in later slasher movies, having that final sting of her hand popping out of the grave, you know, signifying that she's not dead. As I mentioned earlier, Carrie was extremely popular, and for good reason. Brian De Palma is a great director, and I think this is a very good example of his work. And this just led to Stephen King having more and more of a career, you know. And like when I say that, this book opened my eyes. The Dark Half, which once again isn't that great of a book. I mean, I started reading some more contemporary Stephen King, and then started delving into works from his, from like, you know, the peak of his writing, stuff like The Shining, which I've talked about the movie The Shining before, which is very different from the book. Other books like It, which is one of my favorite. It, which of course was made into a TV miniseries in the 90s that I think everyone has fond memories of, just because Tim Curry is fucking amazing in like the 25 minutes that he's in this 4-hour long miniseries. And not to take anything away from Tim Curry, because Tim Curry is great in this, and he's very iconic, and I think that look of the clown and the stupid jokes that Tim Curry spouts in it, I think are what people think of when they think back on that movie. But in 2017, there was the theatrical release of It, which at the time was basically marketed as the story of just the children. For those who are familiar with It, It is about a interdimensional being, this evil entity that has lived in this town of Derry for hundreds of years and has feasted and grown over time, becoming more and more ingrained with the town, almost being a stand-in for the town itself. The this entity, which has a name and I don't remember it, but anyway, this entity, it feeds on people, it feeds on their fears, and it's a shapeshifter. It can take on the shape of your greatest fear, and it targets mostly children. And through that, it has influenced the town of Derry, its history, and the book is basically interspersed. It's three stories interspersed. You have all these takes on the history of the town of Derry, which is something that is usually excised from any from the miniseries and from the movie, and not because it's bad, but I think it just makes it really difficult to follow in a movie. And the other two parts of the book, which I think is what most people think of because of the movie and the miniseries, is we follow this group of friends as children and then once again as grown-ups, because It itself only comes out every so like every 20 years, 22 years, something like that, or 30 years. I'm don't remember the exact number. It's like some autumn, like 27 years or something. In any case, in 2017 we got Andy Muschietti's It, which, if you stick around for the end of it, was actually called It Chapter 1. And this movie basically only focused on the children, updating it from the 1950s to the 1980s, which makes a lot of sense. So it's almost like this movie ended up being super successful, and I'm pretty sure it was greenlit before, but it cemented the fact that there would be a second movie, It Chapter 2, set more in a contemporary day and age. And in It Chapter 1, like I said, we follow this group of kids through this town as they face Pennywise the Clown, which is one of the forms or one of the favorite forms of this entity. And Pennywise, of course, preys on children. He eats them. He puts them into their deadlights. It is amazing. It's the story's great. Like, I love this book, and I think that this movie really captured a lot of what made that book such a great read. We not only have these great kids being able to capture just kind of how kids interact and how they can be dicks to one another, but also can be very caring and be very tight friends and help each other grow. And on top of that, you know, we have this whole backdrop of this killer clown that can turn into anything and is tormenting these children and killing other children as well. And we have nods to some of the side characters, because It is a very long book, and there's no way, outside of making like a, I don't know, 13 episode, like one season show on HBO or Amazon or something like that, where you could capture everything that the book has. And I'm not saying that you need to do that, but It does a great job of kind of capturing these main characters as kids, including the bullies that are going after them, and really kind of keeping the focus on Bill, on stuttering Bill, and the grief and the guilt that he feels over the death of his baby brother, or his little brother, Georgie, who he blames for his death, Georgie being killed in the very beginning of both the book and the movie. But like I said, you know, this leads to this reveal at the end of it where there's going to be a second chapter. And that second chapter, It Chapter 2, wasn't as successful as the first It movie. It came out in 2019, but it basically follows these kids as grown-ups, interspersed with some of their lost memories of things that happened to them when they were kids in the town. And the book has this whole central idea about how these kids are able to almost defeat this entity. They wound it, and in doing so and getting away from the town, they all become successful, except for Mike, who stays behind to be the librarian. But all the other kids leave and they become super successful, but they forget everything that they went through as children. But they made a promise, which is the end of the first movie, that if it ever returned, they would come back. And It Chapter 2 starts where the book starts, where we have the murder of this young gay man who is killed by Pennywise. Knowing that they have to come back, the majority of them do. One of the boys, Stan, as a grown-up, knows what that means and what the entity actually is, and he can't face it, and he ends up committing suicide at the beginning of the story. And so then, as I said, you know, we follow them as adults as they once again face face this entity. And the crazy thing about this is that even though it was one of Stephen King's first books, and I want to say it was written before The Dark Tower, we have these ideas that start showing up and that continue through the majority of his books, which all have ideas from The Dark Tower. And you don't really need to know any of that, but that's to say that in the book, we end up basically having this ritual whereby one of the boys, as grown-ups, they defeat this entity by doing this this ritual of Thogol, which I don't even know how they would have done this, because we have the turtle, like this giant entity that represents everything that's good, and we have this whole psychic battle having to do with like figurative / literal tongue biting and making jokes. It's odd. It's the one thing about Stephen King is he always has these great premises in his stories, and very rarely is he able to stick the landing. There's even a joke about it in It Chapter 2, and the movie ends up changing that, where it's even sillier, where basically Pennywise is ridiculed and bullied by these adults until he becomes a tiny little baby it, and they crush it to death. But it is great. If you're gonna, I would say, like, you really just only need to see the first one. If you want to get a better idea of the whole story, Chapter 2 is definitely flawed. It's almost like this weird horror comedy more than anything, but it's, you know, it's a good representation of what that story is. And for me, I was just glad to see so many of the elements of the book in that movie. And It Chapter 1 did another thing. It really kind of got me back into, and actually both of them, It Chapter 1 and when It Chapter 2 was, when it was announced and they were talking about some of the things happening in the story, I read It like 3 or 4 times when I was in my teens, and I hadn't read it since I was maybe 18, 19, and I had forgotten a lot of it. And so I felt like I needed to go back and at the very least listen to an audiobook version of it, which I did. I listened to the audiobook version of It, narrated by Stephen Weber, and Stephen Weber's amazing in it. I would highly recommend it if you like audiobooks. But that led to kind of me re-embracing Stephen King, not just because there was all these new movies coming out, but it made me want to go back and reread some of the stuff that I had read and go back and reread some of the short stories, because I love Stephen King's short stories. I think I like those more than his short stories and novellas, probably more than the majority of his books. And not that his books are bad, but sometimes he has this knack for just these really, really great short stories. But so I'm in the middle of this kind of like rereading a lot of Stephen King and listening to audiobooks, you know, here and there in the last couple of years. But Stephen King, I mean, he has had so many adaptations, and we have so many adaptations coming up. Some of them that have been really successful, like I mentioned earlier, Carrie or The Shining, and some maybe not so much that weren't as successful. But the great thing about Stephen King is, I think, because of the subject matter of his stories and because of the level of craft in his books, he ends up with a lot of people that a lot of great like directors and a lot of great actors are kind of inspired, or at least are want to kind of do or take on his stories. And I think one of the better takes, and probably one of the more famous ones, is Rob Reiner's Misery. And Misery, which is a book about Stephen King talking about kind of the own backlash that fans had over some of his books that he wrote that were out of the quote-unquote wheelhouse of what Stephen King should be writing. I'm thinking specifically of like Eyes of the Dragon, which is more or less a fantasy kids novel. And I think that came out like right after The Shining. Some fans were upset about that, and Misery is kind of this response to like what people want, because in Misery we follow James Caan, who plays the author Paul Sheldon, who ends up meeting his biggest fan, played Annie Wilkes, played by Kathy Bates. And the most famous character that he's written, that Paul has written, is this character of Misery, and he killed her off in the last book, and Kathy Bates cannot abide that. So through happenstance, she ends up finding him after a car accident and nursing him back to health, but basically forces him to rewrite that ending or rewrite another book that brings Misery back. And it's interesting because the movie came out in 1990, the book came out in the mid-80s. So we're talking about 30, 35 years ago, and already we have this idea of fans feeling the sense of ownership over stories that they like and over what an author gives them, something that we've really seen explode in the last probably 10, 15 years with the backlash to the prequels of Star Wars, the backlash to the sequels to Star Wars, the sequel trilogy when Disney took over, the fact that next year we're getting the Snyder Cut of Justice League as like some 4-hour mega movie that, I mean, Justice League was all right. When I talked about the DCEU, you know, I mentioned how, yeah, it was really jarring, and I don't know, maybe having one coherent voice would have definitely helped it. But at the same time, I don't think we need some 4-hour quote unquote epic to really tell that story. I almost feel like just go back and just do another one, just remake it at this point. Who gives a shit? But you know, there was so much fan backlash and so much like outcry for the Snyder Cut that fans got what they want. And it's interesting that Misery at that time period, and Stephen King, just based on his own experiences, was already talking about that over 30 years ago. It's insane. And I mean, I don't know whether or not the Snyder Cut's going to be good, or if it's going to end up leading to some kind of weird thing where people are like asking for more remakes or more visions, like unadulterated visions of what a movie was supposed to be. Like, I know in the wake of the Snyder Cut being announced, like someone, I believe this was tongue-in-cheek, but someone asked for the Josh Trank Fantastic Four cut, which Josh Trank said that, yeah, nobody needs that. Because nobody does need that. But I think it's just really interesting that that's something that he brought up back then. And Misery itself, I mean, Kathy Bates goes to the point of like breaking Paul Sheldon's legs so that he can't physically leave. And I believe in the story she actually saws off his foot. But I mean, smashing someone's legs with a sledgehammer is fucking nasty enough. And even like at the end of it where he has to kill her to survive, like the way that Kathy Bates plays it, it's almost like this euphoric experience kind of going back to Carrie. And I think there's a lot of that in King's work. One, it's like the impact that authors have, not the importance of them, but how they can have an impact, how people take on these stories, the importance of storytelling, and how obsession really warps people and their sense of reality. And Misery is a really good example of that. And these are all, you know, juicy, juicy tidbits of horror that we're getting in this. Now, as I mentioned, a lot of varied directors, a lot of great directors have worked on Stephen King movies. I mentioned The Dead Zone with David Cronenberg, or I may not have, but David Cronenberg directed The Dead Zone, and that was starring Christopher Walken. In 1983, John Carpenter, who I basically feel like I've talked about all of his 80s movies, he directed Christine. And Christine was another book that I really enjoyed, which is basically about this possessed car. So it's almost like instead of a haunted house, it's a haunted car. And John Carpenter played this movie almost as like this relationship, and this elements are in the book itself. It's not something he made up, but almost like how the main character has this relationship with the car itself, and the car is killing people because of jealousy. And I think that point is driven home by like the music choices in the movie, and I'm pretty sure those are in the, it's been a while since I've read Christine, but I'm pretty sure some of those are in the book as well, because that's one thing, like Stephen King always loves to have these lyrics from, or mention, like, music, you know, specifically rock and roll, and I guess what people would consider dad rock nowadays. But yeah, like Christine has, like, you know, like, this, like, doo-wop classic, like, You're Mine, like, you know, You're Mine, and you'll, I'm not even gonna try to sing it. anyway, but yeah, like, the car itself, is, like, almost indestructible, and there's a couple notable things about Christine. This is a movie that John Carpenter basically felt like he had to do, like, he was forced by the studio to do it, and he kind of just phoned it in. But at this time, this is, like, right after The Thing, John Carpenter was so damn good at what he did that even him phoning in his job and just being checked out still leads to a really, really enjoyable movie, and a movie that's definitely worth checking out. I think it's one of his lesser known movies, and in that itself, I think a lot of people haven't seen it because of that, so it's definitely worth checking out. And I think it really kind of plays up a lot of the stuff that King also likes, like this almost fetishistic nostalgia for the 1950s when he was a kid, you know, which is fine, because I think I have that same thing with the 1980s when I was a kid. Not that I'm an author, because I'm not, and even if I was, not that I'm on the level of a Stephen King. Another person that I think has become synonymous with movies with Stephen King is Frank Darabont, who directed The Shawshank Redemption, which according to IMDb is the best movie ever, which is bullshit, but regardless, it's a good movie. It's infinitely watchable. He also directed The Green Mile, which I don't really care for. But the only horror, like straight-up horror movie that Darabont has done based on Stephen King's work, because both The Green Mile and The Shawshank Redemption aren't horror stories. There's horror elements in them, but they're not. They're more, one's more of a drama and another one's more of this, well, I guess they're both dramas, but one has more fantastical elements. One has more, getting raped in prison, I would consider that as being, or getting raped in general, that's horror. There's horror, those are horror elements, but neither one of them are straight up horror. But Darabont, in 2007, gave us The Mist. The Mist is this amazing, underrated movie that is so fucking nihilistic. The story itself is, it's a novella that King wrote as part of, I believe it was in Four Seasons. I might be wrong about that. But in any case, The Mist has to do with this unexplained emergence of these, this mist, and within that mist are these giant, like, non-earthly creatures, like giant bugs, tentacle monsters, like straight up like Cthulhu sort of elder god Lovecraftian monsters, not Cthulhu. And the story revolves around this group of people that are trapped in a supermarket, including an artist, David Drayton, played by Thomas Jane, and them these group of people trying to survive and trying not to go out into the mist to get devoured by these things. Of course, you know, shit goes wrong and people are killed. Some of these animals or these beings get into the store, and we also have one of the best Stephen King villains of all time in this movie, and that's Mrs. Carmody, played by Marcia Gay Harden. Mrs. Carmody, who is another religious zealot, because Stephen King definitely goes back to the religion well a lot in his stories. He has quite the outlook on Christianity. But Miss Carmody, who through a cult of personality ends up getting people to believe that they need to sacrifice amongst their people to these gods, to these beings outside, in order to survive, and she channels in on David's son as their sacrifice. David, of course, and while we have all these horrific elements, these otherworldly beings and all this shit going on outside, we get as much horror just from people giving in to this sense of authority that Miss Carmody has because God talks to her. Someone that in any other circumstance would just be looked at as a fucking crazy person, but when people are at their wits' ends, when they're scared, you know, they jump to whatever they can find, and people latch onto Miss Carmody, and we kind of get almost like this, these two camps within, within this, this convenience store, and eventually the survivors have to escape. And the group of survivors led by Thomas Jane, in the book, in the novella, they're able to reach a hotel, and they get this, they hear on the radio, like, this military broadcast, and there's this glimmer of hope that they might be able to survive. Not so in the movie. In the movie, Thomas Jane realizes that they're not going to make it. These creatures are coming, and he'd rather kill everybody and commit suicide before those creatures arrive. And he does. He kills everyone, including his son. And he's about to blow his own brains out when he realizes he doesn't have enough bullets. He goes out of the car that they're in into this mist to embrace these beings to kill him. But the being that is coming close to him is actually a tank. The army has arrived and they've beaten back these monsters. Because one of the things in the book, and it's intimated in the story, in the movie as well, is that there was some military experiments that went awry and they ended up ripping a hole in time and space. And so these beings from another dimension came over. And amongst the people that are with the military is a woman who, at the very beginning of the story, when all the shit hits the fan, she takes off into the mist by herself to find her kids. And she's there with her kids. She has faith that she can, you know, that she'll survive. Thomas Jane gives in to despair. And because of that, he loses everything. This movie is, like I said, very nihilistic. It's very fucked up. It's amazing. It's great. Darabont released this on DVD later with a black and white cut, which really kind of gives us this great, like, Outer Limits Twilight Zone feel. Because one of the things about the movie, well, the special effects are mostly great. Some of the CGI is pretty shitty, but in black and white, it's almost like watching an old-timey horror movie. So it really, really, really helps. I would say, if you're gonna watch The Mist, if you've never seen it, watch the black and white version. It just gives it this whole aesthetic. It's very much like watching Mad Max Fury Road in the you know, silver and chrome version of that, where it's in black and white. Another movie that came out in 2007 was 1408, which was from a short story, and I mean short, this is like, I think, 22 pages long, by Stephen King. 1408 is one of the few, well, no, it's one of the stories from his books that really kind of freaked me out when I was reading it. I remember just being able to hear a pin drop. I was so focused and just kind of feeling this sense of, like, goosebumps all over me, just because of what the story's about. Basically, the movie expands that short story, which in the story itself, we are following this guy who enters this haunted room, and it's snippets of him talking into a recorder over, like, a couple of hours. And it's literally just snippets, so it's all out of context. So they expand that for the movie, which stars one of my favorite actors, John Cusack, as Mike Enslin. And the other major, because there's really only, like, two major characters in the short story, the other major character is played by Samuel L. Jackson. 1408 is this great, really effective little short, kind of like this intimate ghost story, and it's really effective even as a movie. I think the fact that it plays with how things are set up and it rewinds time as part of what's going on, it's disorienting, and it really kind of helps with you with having this sense of almost of inevitability of what's going to happen. Interestingly enough, if you ever watch it on Blu-ray, there's like three alternate endings for some reason. They kind of work. Like, I think the theatrical version works. There's some versions that are a bit more hopeful than what we get in the movie, in the theatrical version. But 1408, I think, is one of those movies that I think a lot of people just kind of slept on, didn't go out of their way to watch. But it's definitely worth checking out. Speaking of movies that people haven't gone out of their way to see. I love The Mangler from 1995. This is a straight up terrible fucking movie. It's based on also a extremely short story by Stephen King. I want to say the short story. I'm talking like 12 pages. Like, this is really short, and they turn this into a feature length movie, directed by Tobe Hooper, starring Robert Englund, Freddy Krueger himself, and Ted Levine, who was Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs, and also he was on Monk. And The Mangler, like, you would think, like, how can you have a movie directed by Tobe Hooper, written by Stephen King, with Robert Englund and Ted Levine, and how is that going to be terrible? Well, the reason is that it's about a haunted laundry folding machine that kills people. So the setup for it is just ridiculous on its face, but I love that short story, and just the fact that they went and did this into a movie, and this is just straight up, like, mid-90s cheese. This is total schlock. It's probably somewhat unwatchable, but this is something where I'd put this up there with, like, oh, I don't know, like, maybe some of the later Jaws sequels, or, like, some of those really shitty slasher movies that, like, are super low budget. It's fun. I enjoyed this movie. I think it's on Prime, but not that anyone's ever going to go out of their way to watch this, but if you ever come across it, you should check it out. Probably one of the most famous books that Stephen King has written, and one of his best ones, is Pet Sematary, which follows the story of the Gage family moving into their new home, and tragedy that befalls based on where they live, next to this road where people regularly speed, and it leads to the death of their cat, who a neighbor tells Lewis, I'm sorry, did I say the Gage family? The Creed family. Gage is their son. Their neighbor, Judd Crandall, tells Lewis about this pet cemetery where animals come back to life. Lewis, in his grief, doesn't want to tell his kids about it, about their cat dying, so he takes it up there. But the cat comes back different. And in 1989, this was turned into a movie that I know a lot of people really, really love. It's directed by Mary Lambert. I didn't really care for this movie. I think I was really thrown by Fred Gwynne as Judd Crandall. Fred Gwynne, who famously played Herman Munster, and he has just this whole Northern Maine accent that is just so, I mean, I couldn't get past it, and I think that for me just really kind of ruined the movie. It's not to say the movie's badly done or anything, and this is probably one of the few movies I could think of where they show a 2-year-old child getting run over by a big rig while they're listening to the Ramones. The driver's listening to the Ramones as this happens. And like I said, there's this whole subplot with Rachel, with Gage's mom, having these flashbacks to her sister, who I believe had spina bifida, but it's all almost shown as like this really debilitating disease. I feel like it's really exaggerated, but it's definitely horrific looking. I love the book Pet Sematary, and I don't know if part of it is, since this is one of my favorite Stephen King books, I didn't care for the movie because of that, and that along with Fred Gwynne's accent just kind of threw me out. But I feel like this is one of those that maybe I might need to give another chance, just because I know that it's well made, and it's makes for an interesting movie at the very least. And if a movie inspires a Ramones song on top of that, because there is the Ramones song Pet Sematary, or at least they were, you know, tapped to write a song for it, it's got to be worth checking out. Pet Sematary itself was remade in 2019 to much lesser effect. Even based on what I remember from that movie and not liking the 1989 one, the 2019 one is not as effective. They make changes to the story just to shake things up, and it really kind of derails a lot of what made the book memorable and what made the movie memorable, because we have this killer baby in it, basically. Instead, in this movie, we have a little girl, so their daughter, who is in the story, but they basically switch it. Instead of Gage being killed, it's their daughter Ellie who is killed and brought back as zombie, I guess. There's this whole idea of a Wendigo, and like, I mean, I don't even remember if that's in, I'm pretty sure that's in the book, but yeah, it kind of goes into just the folklore of the local Indian tribes. But yeah, I mean, if the, of the two, if you're gonna watch one, I would say go with the 89 one. Don't bother with the one from last year. It's not that great. One of the things that I also love about Stephen King, because he's made short stories, we have like these movies that are really, really well made, these movies that have these really wonderful themes, and then we have just some straight up just like dumb stories like The Mangler. Another one that I really enjoyed from 1990 is Graveyard Shift, which is about this old textile mill that has this huge rat infestation. And when I mean huge rats, I mean like literal like rat kings and shit like that. Brad Dourif is in this as an exterminator, and he was like my favorite part of this movie. This is another one where I enjoyed the short story, which isn't anywhere near as silly as the movie. This is just a really silly 90s movie, but I really like it, and I just kind of wanted to mention it just because it's one that I enjoyed. Speaking of silly high concept and cheesy horror movies, Stephen King did actually direct a movie. In 1986, he directed Maximum Overdrive, which was based on his short story, Trucks. And once again, this is just a short story. It's expanded into this movie where we have this comet that passes over the Earth, and there's something in the trail of that comet that causes all cars and trucks to come alive. And we end up following this group of people who are in a truck stop as they are being chased and tormented by trucks and big rigs, one of which famously has the face of the Green Goblin on it. And it's almost kind of like they're the de facto leader of these trucks, which is insane because the Green Goblin is a Marvel property. And that in the 1980s, there were that's how flippant they were about just letting other people use their IP. Maximum Overdrive is extremely silly. It is not good, but it's a lot of fun. And sometimes that's really all that you need, is just a fun movie. And if you want to just see something that is basically directed by a coked out Stephen King, and you want to know what that's like, then you got to watch. You got to check out Maximum Overdrive. Now, I've been talking for quite a while, but there's one last movie that I wanted to talk about, and that's Salem's Lot, which was, here in America at least, was a miniseries that came out on TV in 1979, but was recut for European audiences with more gore and, well, they cut some of the shit out as a theatrical release. And I want to end with Salem's Lot because Salem's Lot is probably my favorite Stephen King novel. Salem's Lot is basically Stephen King's Dracula. Like, that's the easiest way to think about it. We follow, once again, a novelist, because there's usually the protagonist is usually going to be a novelist in Stephen King stories, who goes back to, this novelist's name is Ben Mears, and he goes back to his town of Jerusalem's Lot that he grew up in. And in that town, along with him coming back, there is this new couple. In the book, there are a couple of older European gentlemen, Mr. Barlow and Mr. Straker, who open a curio shop. In the movie, we never actually see Barlow, during the day at least. We only see Straker. And the reason for that is that Barlow is a vampire. In the movie version of Salem's Lot, Barlow basically looks like, his look is very much modeled on Max Schreck in Nosferatu. It's a very sinister, rat-like creature, kind of this idea of this elder Carpathian vampire. And I use the term Carpathian based on just some of like other movies that talk about different types of vampires, or even like What We Do in the Shadows. But Salem's Lot also has this subplot having to do with this evil home, which is where Straker and Barlow move into, where years before that, the owner committed suicide, and this owner was someone who kidnapped and murdered and probably raped children. And the thing is that there's this whole idea that the town, everyone in the town kind of knew that this was going on with this child rapist or child murderer, And they never did anything about it. They just kind of kept the town secrets. They would just tell people, you know, just be careful around them. They would tell the kids, don't go there. And that was it. That's where they would leave it at. It's almost like they were just inviting evil to come in. I really enjoy this book just because I enjoy the story of Dracula. The book, if you've ever tried to read the novel Dracula, it can be very dry at times. And I felt that this was a much better take on it as a novel. The movie itself, like I said, it was directed by Tobe Hooper, and I think some of the scenes have just become iconic. First of all, the look of Barlow, but also the idea that you need to be let in, you need to be invited in as a vampire in order to enter someone's house. And the way that that's shown in the movie and in the book as well is that first, children start getting turned into vampires. And they go back to their homes and they first come like to their mothers, you know, like, oh, it's my son. He's come back for me, and turn them into vampires. Then they go to their friends' houses. And it's almost like this evil, this rot that is setting into this town, and no one can do anything to stop it. Now, Ben and a couple of other people who are basically all stand-ins for like Jonathan Harker and the other people that help him out in Dracula, along with one of the kids who Mark, if I remember correctly, I'm blanking on names. They end up little by little fighting back and trying to take out people, and eventually, you know, the town is overrun. Even though they're able to stop Barlow, you know, it's not enough. The town is going to be taken over, and they need to escape. The other great thing about this, going back to that theme about religion and about spirituality that King is always talking about, we have the character of Father Callahan, who, in a moment of faith, he's someone who's kind of started to question his faith, and in the moment where he has to fight Barlow, he is able to hold his own until his faith falters. And in that faltering of his faith, Barlow turns him into not a vampire, but he basically desecrates his body so he can not be a priest anymore, and he lets him go, and Father Callahan takes off. And you know, that's the last you saw of Father Callahan until Wolves of the Calla, one of the Dark Tower books, where he shows up in the story of Roland. And the Dark Tower itself, even amongst King fans, there's some that don't really care for it, and that's really more of a epic fantasy series of novels, not so much horror. There are horror elements in it, but not straight up horror. Stephen King, I think, is an important voice in horror. He, ever since Carrie up until now, and probably up until, you know, he dies, or up until after he dies and they posthumously, you know, publish whatever stories he had lying around, which, I mean, Stephen King isn't as prolific as he was before, but he's still pretty damn prolific. But I think Stephen King, like I said, the true appeal of him, at least for me, and I think the reason that he's hit with so many people, that he's been able to be so popular, is because he's talking about us, and he's using horror as a way to kind of hook us in order to talk about human nature. And in the end, a lot of times, that's what horror really is about. Horror allows us to kind of be able to address our own mortality, our own spirituality, our own, what makes us us, you know? And it does it in a way where we put our guard down because we're looking for a visceral reaction, much like in comedy, except we're looking to scream or to be afraid and to face those things that go bump in the night, or that keep us up till 3 o'clock in the morning wondering what comes next, what did we fuck up, what do we regret, what choices that we've made, you know, that sort of thing. And that, I think, not only encapsulates the appeal of King, but horror itself, as I said. I love horror, movies, radio shows, comics, books, short stories. And I think it's because it helps me to face the biggest fears that I have. The fears of my own mortality, the fears of having to deal with society's ills, of the legacy that I leave behind for my kids, you know? And there's just something that appeals to me about seeing monsters and seeing the humanity in those monsters sometimes, and seeing what those monsters reflect about us. This has been a blast, kind of just being able to talk about horror movies, and I hope that you've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed talking about it. And that's it. We've reached the end of our countdown. Happy Halloween, everybody.